headlines, Iran's president starting an official visit to Russia says Tehran-Moscow cooperation can serve as a deterrent to global unilateralism. Israeli forces demolish a Palestinian home in the Flashpoint Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied East Al-Quds. Well, the World Health Organization is warning that the COVID pandemic is far from over, as many countries are facing a surge in Omicron infections.
Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News.
We start in Moscow where Russian President Vladimir Putin is hosting President Ebrahim Raisi of Iran, arriving there a short while ago for a two-day visit. The two presidents are set to meet for wide-ranging discussions on matters that concern them. Raisi is also scheduled to give an address to a plenary session of Duma, the lower house of the Russian parliament. Prior to his departure, the Iranian president said closer cooperation would benefit both countries. He said stronger bonds between the two states would also help security, economy, and trade ties in the region and serve as a deterrent to global unilateralism. This is Raisi's third foreign visit since taking office in July. Iran's oil, foreign, and economy ministers are part of his entourage.
A meaningful leap forward. That's how the Iranian foreign minister termed the expansion of interactions between Tehran and Moscow ahead of Iran's president visit. In an article written for the Sputnik news agency, Hossein Amir Abdollahian talks about Tehran's new roadmap based on which cooperation with all neighbors, especially those in the Russian Federation, is a priority. Describing Russia as a powerful neighbor and friend with ties based on respect and mutual interests, the top diplomat says Tehran is setting the stage for expanded cooperation in a wide range of fields. From economy, culture and science to technology, defense and security, the opportunities for partnership are immense. Parliamentary and media projects also provide good grounds for cooperation. The two sides also have a lot to discuss when it comes to regional developments, including the West Asia region, South Caucasus and Central Asia, and international matters such as Vienna negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran deal. But how can these matters be addressed given the West's anti-Iran and anti-Russia approach? Tehran and Moscow share common views on geopolitical issues in West Asia, which is already facing numerous challenges, from war and foreign military interventions to economic instability. The situation in Afghanistan, Syria, and Yemen are some instances where the two sides share similar perspectives. Amir Abdollahian argues that by holding bilateral consultations and preventing third parties from playing a role in the region, the two states can settle regional issues, especially at a time when unilateralism has proven to be a failed strategy. On security, Moscow has provided Tehran with military equipment, such as the S-300 missiles, which along with Iran's domestic advancements can help boost the nation's defense capabilities in the face of foreign threats and promote regional defense and security capabilities. This will also help the two countries expand their fight against terrorism. In the field of economy, the two countries have huge unexploited potential. The trade volume currently ranges between $2 and $3 billion a year, which is way below expectations. A 20-year cooperation agreement the two sides signed in 2001 expired last year. An extension of that agreement, probably to be brought up in the ongoing talks, will make it possible for both sides to boost trade, which experts believe can be upgraded to the level of $20 billion a year. The relationship takes on added significance, especially at a time when both countries are hit by U.S. sanctions. That can unite the two states by joint motivation to try and circumvent those sanctions by taking steps such as the exclusion of the dollar from their mutual transactions. As it seems, Tehran and Moscow are on the path to capitalizing on their political solidarity and expanding their relations, as well as consolidating their ties with other countries in the East to build a united front in the face of the West's hostile agenda.
Joining us now from the Russian capital is our correspondent, Marina Kortunova. Marina, welcome to the program. Talk to us about the significance of this trip by an Iranian delegation headed by the President Ebrahim Raisi, and also, if you may, what's on the agenda of this meeting for the next 2 days?
First of all, general words. It is planned to discuss the whole range of issues of bilateral cooperation, including the implementation of joint projects in the trade and economic sphere, as well as current international and regional topics. In addition, it is meant to pay attention to the implementation of the joint comprehensive plan of action on the Iranian nuclear problem. Well, now back to Russia. The dynamics of Russian-Iranian relations is as follows. In the first 9 months of the Iranian year, March-December 2021, trade between our countries increased by 41%, according to the Iranian Customs Administration. And the trade turnover between Iran and Russia is worth $1.655 billion. Despite the cheerful optimism and the dynamics of 41%, these figures are not particularly significant for the Russian Federation, so there will be one aspect of negotiations to boost these trade figures and to develop more trade between our countries. Iran, through its diplomatic mission in Russia, has already voiced its desire to become a regional operator for the purchase of Russian grain. I know that a terminal for this is being built in North Ossetia, and Iran plans to make the most of its transit routes, ports, and logistics as an operator between Russia, India, and China. Iran also made a grain offer to India and plans to join the EREU Customs Union, Eurasian Economic Union. Earlier, Foreign Minister Lavrov, following negotiations with his Iranian counterpart Abdullahian in autumn, said that Moscow positively assesses Iran's interaction with SCO and EREU countries. That is, Moscow and the Shanghai Group in China are powerfully helping Iran survive and trade. Thus, the temporary agreement leading to the formation of a free trade zone with Iran, signed on May 17th in 2018 and entered into force in October 2019, led to the fact that the trade turnover between the EREU countries and Iran increased by almost 20%. To $2.9 billion, and it is not bad for a start, but Iran has grandiose plans. Russia has its own interests as well. So tomorrow, let us pass today's negotiations with President Putin. Tomorrow, the attention of the world press will be riveted on the long-discussed but not yet confirmed deal on the sale of Russian weapons to Iran in the amount of $10 billion. Which of the plans between Iran and Russia is destined to come true, and whether any surprises are prepared, we will find out tomorrow as well. But about one surprise, and what a surprise, we can say for sure with certainty, for the first time in history, the president of Iran will speak from the rostrum of the State Duma of the Russian Federation. And he will address the plenary session of the Duma, the lower house of the Russian parliament. And I must admit personally, and everybody here in Russia, that everyone was very surprised by this news. Not a single president of a foreign power has made an appeal in our Russian State Duma. So we are waiting with a big interest. Iran and Russia, which are both under Western sanctions, have in recent years developed close relations in political, security, defense, economic, and energy fields. And they are currently implementing joint projects in oil, gas, nuclear, and railway sectors.
Thanks a lot, Marina Kurtanova, joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow. Elsewhere, several months since the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan, and still no official recognition from world countries. Now the group is making another call to address the issue. The Taliban's acting prime minister has especially urged the Islamic countries to start the recognition and take lead in the process. Mohammad Hassan Akhund says if that happens, the Taliban will then be able to develop quickly. The Taliban formed a government after taking control over Afghanistan back in August. Since then, however, no country has recognized their administration. Even Afghanistan's neighboring countries have been reluctant, calling for an inclusive government to be formed there. Meanwhile, the U.S. and other Western states have frozen billions of dollars of Afghan banking assets, and its development funding has been cut off following the Taliban takeover. This is worse than the humanitarian situation in a country already ravaged by two decades of war. And today marks Gaza Day, a day in commemoration of the resistance of the people of the Gaza Strip against Israeli hostilities. This day was designated after a major Israeli military campaign against Gaza in 2008. During 22 days of that war, thousands of Palestinians were killed and many others were injured. However, the regime failed to achieve any of its goals and was pushed back due to the resistance of the Palestinian people. Iranians also mark this day to voice their support for the steadfastness of the Palestinians. For more than a decade, the Gaza Strip has been under a constant Israeli blockade. This in addition to the regime's other offensive operations, including the bombardment of civilian infrastructure, has affected the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza. And now to the occupied Al-Quds, where the Israeli regime has just demolished another home, displacing yet another Palestinian family as part of its expansion's policy. In the early hours of the morning today, Israeli army bulldozers moved in to destroy the building located in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The demolition, as can be expected, outraged the local Palestinians. Israeli security forces were also present at the scene, and they arrested a total of 18 people, including members of the family who lived in that building. The family has been facing an eviction threat since 2017. Israel says a school will have to be constructed on the parcel of land where the home was located. The fate of hundreds of Palestinians living in the controversial neighborhood has been hanging in the balance for years. The regime has been seeking to drive out dozens of families living there. Palestinians see the move as part of Israel's ethnic cleansing and Judaization attempts. The growing leadership challenge is not the only political problem for British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government. His latest predicament is a record inflation level. Annual consumer price inflation is running at 5.4%. Inflation is widely expected to peak in April when household energy bills are regulated to increase by around 50%. The opposition is using this trend to further tighten the grip on Johnson. They're calling on the Prime Minister to offset the rise in energy bills. After a national weekend of action across Britain against a proposed new law that would give police extra powers to curb protests, the upper chamber of the country's parliament has introduced multiple amendments to it, while campaigners are calling for it to be thrown out. Said Putazaz's report from London.
The right to assemble, to be heard, a cornerstone of democracy, potentially under the UK government legislation that give police sweeping new powers. Aye, it matters. Women being manhandled and handcuffed by police for attending a peaceful vigil held last year in the wake of 33-year-old Sarah Everard's murder at the hands of a police officer.
While the Conservative government claims the bill is aimed at proactively preventing chaos and disruption caused, for example, by people who glue their faces to motorways, its critics say the bill is not about law and order, but about taking away their right to protest.
The proposed legislation was quickly pushed through the House of Commons last year. This week it was put up for debate at the upper chamber of the UK Parliament amid cries of kill the bill from drum-beating protesters forming an emotive backdrop to it outside the legislative body. What ensued was several amendments made to the proposed legislation to the chagrin of the government. Campaigners say the parliamentary defeat came because people took to the streets and raised the alarm about the government's growing authoritarianism. They say it is now time to build the movement and kill the contentious bill once and for all. Saeed Purizap, London.
Well, the World Health Organization is warning that the COVID pandemic is far from over, as many countries are facing a surge in Omicron infections. The WHO chief has cautioned against the assumption that Omicron is milder than the previous variants. He says Omicron is causing hospitalizations and deaths like the other ones. It is now the dominant variant in the world. In recent weeks, European countries have broken new case records several times. France is reporting nearly 500,000 new cases a day. That's the highest ever recorded tally since the start of the pandemic. Italy has also registered a record single-day caseload of 228,000. And EU officials claim those refusing to be vaccinated against COVID-19 and contributing to economic uncertainty across the 27-country bloc. More than 100 million adults in the EU are refusing to take the jab. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The latest data published by the European Medicines Agency on Tuesday shows 20% of adults in the EU are unwilling to get a coronavirus vaccine. And only 40% of adults have opted to take a booster jab. Many citizens remain divided on the subject of vaccination.
For now, no. I don't know how safe is it. I don't know how safe is a vaccine to do it.
A lot of businesses getting shut down and stuff. So I think the faster we get the vaccine, the faster we'll open things back up.
Also on Tuesday, EU finance ministers met to discuss the impact of ongoing COVID-19 restrictions, supply chain bottlenecks, labour shortages, rising energy prices, and record high Eurozone inflation.
While these negative factors are lasting longer than first anticipated, they should ease in the course of this year. We expect EU's economic growth to continue this year and next.
But that won't immediately fix the growing social crisis in the EU. Experts say the pandemic has highlighted the consequences of privatizing essential services across the bloc, such as healthcare.
There is a problem behind, and in my understanding, it is very much ideological, because this idea of less state, less public investment, less public infrastructure, this is now paying off in a negative sense.
Due to continued partial lockdowns and travel restrictions, EU finance ministers say the true economic impact of Brexit has not yet been exposed. In this regard, it's claimed COVID-19 is actually acting as a shield for authorities in Brussels, but perhaps particularly in London. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iranian leather production dates back thousands of years. In fact, Iran is one of the oldest leather producers in the world. Ancient artifacts show Iranians were using leather to make shoes, clothes, and weapons at the height of the Bronze Age in the 15th century BC. Historically, Iranian leather was always a welcomed import because of its high quality and the country's strategic location along the Silk Road. The leather production legacy continues to this day, but it looks a lot different with the evolution of technology and industry. Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of Bazaar with me, Sarah Adema. This week, we will take a close look at the leather industry while shining the spotlight on shoe productions. We wanted to see how much leather is produced in Iran and what some of its major uses are. We will also check out some of the contributions of this industry to Iran's national economy. So let's get started. To become more familiar with the leather industry, we visited Adura, which is a company that specializes in making leather footwear for women. This company has been around for two decades. Its production hall is enormous, and it all starts with the raw material. First, leather material is sorted based on quality grades. Then, patterns are cut. The pieces are then sent to a section devoted to making the shoe uppers. The preparation room is where the pieces are stamped with markers and eyelets are punched. From here, leather parts are taken to a completely mechanized montage division. After the upper part of the shoe is stitched, the insoles are assembled onto the shoe and sent to the finishing room. At this stage, shoes are polished, decorated, and as the name implies, the finishing touches are added, preparing them for packaging and distribution. This company carries out quality control checks on all stages of production. They use highest-grade leather produced in the country and chose material that follows international grading processes. Following international guidelines also helps them on the path of exports. Some time ago, it overhauled its production unit and mechanized many processes to maintain consistent high quality. And one way to do this is by automating repetitive processes. Now, not every shoe manufacturer is the same. Some shoes can be created in hundreds of steps, but don't worry, we won't take you through all of them. On another note, it's important for manufacturers to produce products along international standards. This, in the long run, helps producers stay up to date with regulations, allowing them to export their items easily when they are able to. Maintaining quality is key in staying relevant in any market for the shoe industry, and it is no different. Shoe production has its own specific standards, and most of the quality comes from the material used and the way shoes are crafted with attention to flawlessly executing details. This company adheres to strict standards set by Iwan's Bureau of Standards as well as international criteria for productions. Plus, it has received its operational licenses from the Ministry of Industry and other affiliated organizations. It might be interesting to know that this company has previously indirectly exported its products, meaning clothing and apparel companies would purchase from this brand and sell these items along with their own products to customers abroad. This manufacturer has an eye on the future and is already expanding its production facilities. They hope to launch a second production unit in the near future, which will incorporate men's footwear as well. But that's not all. They also have plans to further develop and expand the industry as a whole. Its unique philosophy regarding the U.S.-imposed sanctions has been a driving force behind its massive productions. They viewed sanctions as a blessing in disguise that helps strengthen production in this field. In general, Iwan's leather is a high-potential market because of its soaring added value profits. For example, the export of one leather jacket is 5 times more profitable than a single barrel of oil. Iwan is among the top 3 leather producers and exporters of semi-finished products. Plus, the country is globally ranked 3rd in terms of quantity and quality of leather produced. Global leather experts consider Iranian sheepskin as the best leather in the world. They say this leather is easier to process and has less odor. Some of the finest sheep leather comes from the Mogan Plain and its surrounding regions. Additionally, the best cow and goat leather belongs to areas in Iwan with dry climates. This is because there are fewer diseases and animals suffering fewer environmental scratches. Those who have the potential for animal husbandry have also turned their gaze towards leather production. This is true for the nomadic communities in the country as well. Skins and hides from livestock used for food production are used in the leather industry too. There are some 230 active leather producing units that employ well over 3,800 people. That's according to the Leather Industries Association in Iran. Some of the most famous provinces for leather production include East Azerbaijan, Tehran, Khorasan, and Hamadan, among others. Most of the leather companies belong to the private sector. Many of these factories are working at only 40% of their total production capacities despite high levels of investment in the domestic industry. This is partly because of the limitations in infrastructure, technical facilities, and modern technology. Domestic leather production has come a long way from traditional production methods. Right now, most of Iran's leather exports are in the form of raw materials, but exports of other leather products, such as shoes and clothing, are also on the rise. Nevertheless, industry participants are grappling with some major obstacle which has drawn the attention of the government. Surprisingly, 80% of Iwan's sheepskin and 20% of goatskin are exported to Italy, Turkey, and Russia, just to name a few. Iwan is well known in the international raw material market, but because of its shy presence of finished products, exported materials often return to Iwan at exorbitant prices. The problem is that the production chain is not complete. Part of the chain, including shoe soles and other accessories, is not produced domestically on a large scale. This has led to costly imports of items that can be potentially manufactured locally. In recent years, the government has taken steps towards supporting domestic manufacturers. One such program is to offer financial assistance to companies in need of capital. Also, a few years back, manufacturers were competing with smuggled goods. In order to increase market regulation and stabilize conditions for healthy competition, the government implemented a campaign against illicit imports and contraband. All things considered, some 120 million cubic meters of light leather and over 230 million cubic meters of heavy leather were produced in the country last year. That's according to Iwan's Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. The majority of leather used in the industry is supplied domestically, which is complemented by a small amount of imports. The leather industry has so much untapped potential and promises a bright future. There are numerous opportunities for investment in this field, particularly in technology and production machinery, as well as packaging, distribution, and branding.
The medical device industry is the second most profitable global commercial enterprise. This is followed by oil, gas, and petrochemical sectors. Iran's healthcare system is far more modern than many might expect. From family planning to organ transplants and cosmetic surgery, the medical sector is progressive and advanced. Considered a high-tech industry, the medical device field is heavily regulated, with large investments going towards R&D activities. A lot happens behind the scenes before medicine and medical treatments reach a patient. This time, we will venture through Iran's medical device industry while giving center stage to advanced laboratory technology. We'll take a look at some of the major players in this field, plus check out why this technology is important to the health sector. Moreover, we will uncover the contributions of this industry to the national economy. Our journey took us to a knowledge-based company that specializes in producing high-tech medical lab equipment and instruments. Noyan Negin Parsian was first established in 2006 with the goal of improving the quality of medical diagnosis and scientific advancement in labs. The ultimate objective is to improve the health of the patients.
I remember back then, since the 2007, it was around 14 years ago, the technology was not so fast in this area. So we have to seek for opportunities in order to work with the good brands. And from that time, our aim was to introduce the technologies that works in regarding of better diagnosis and also service better for the human beings. And from the very beginning, it was our aim in order to work in this field, and also it was the target to reach there.
This knowledge-based company began its activities in the field of research. Then it moved on to manufacturing and importing medical lab tech.
By working with very good brands, we were managed to introduce high-quality products, especially in the field of in vitro diagnostic devices and also reagents. And we introduced many big brands into this, into this system. And at that time, I remember there was very few suppliers in this case, but since the technology went through and also the new platforms have been introduced to the society, the quality of the services also increased, and we were managed to adapt ourselves with the, life and also with the performances of the devices that were offering to the human services.
Among its products, one can name controllers or diagnostic kits for infectious diseases and cancer. Plus, they make lab consumable products such as thinners and substrate liminal, which is a type of chemical that reacts to light as a byproduct. In short, this company has strived to automate manual systems in medical labs. Previously, most processes in labs were carried out by hand. This is both costly and time-consuming with low output. Having numerous people working on one lab project also increases the margin of error, which is potentially detrimental to the final diagnosis of a patient.
Back then, I remember there was very, very few automatic systems. Everything was done by manual systems. I mean, when you go to the laboratory, you would find out that everything is done totally by manual systems. There has been some employees over there which were working just like shift by shift and process by process until a test has been done. And it was a very, very costly and also at the same time time-taking and also with a very, very low output. The results were not that accurate.
Importing medical products can rack up a mighty bill for labs. Importing processes and clearances can sometimes take months before critical products reach consumers. It's noteworthy that imports cost billions in capital flight. And more often than not, patients are the ones paying the high prices of these imports. With this in mind, many domestic manufacturers have stepped in to fill the market void and reduce dependency on imports. One of the main goals of this company is to indigenize local knowledge and technology by strengthening research and development. It has received its permits from the National Medical Device Directorate and the Ministry of Health and Medical Education.
So, finally speaking, I remember it was the year 2012 or 2013 that we found out some potential suppliers and started drawing out the requirements of what is the requirements of the market, what the customer is looking for, what they want from us, and how we can match their requirements with the potential suppliers, and how we can build this line in order to move this technology and transfer this technology back to Iran. It took a long time because we have got around, if I say correctly, two or three failures until we found out how we can reach to this technology in order to present it to the society of the laboratory and also diagnostic systems in Iran.
Among its competitive advantages, one can name the low cost of production relative to foreign brands. Additionally, it has access to advanced scientific knowledge and research that already exists within the country. Dependability and accuracy are key components that increase the quality of its products. And manufacturing them with precision and consistent quality is no easy task.
Well, the first thing talks in Iran is the quality. We never sacrifice the quality in comparison with anything else. Despite on pricing, performances, after sales, the quality talks first. Because we're dealing with something which in its platform and its results, the quality is the first thing that talks. If you go to a laboratory and you don't have quality, you have nothing. In other words, in laboratory, the performances and quality and the pricing are the things that go step by step. It means that you first need to have a quality, and then you need to have a performance, and later on you need to have a price. So
this knowledge-based company collaborates with academic institutions and research firms. Plus, it makes its products along the axis of exports, meaning all productions follow stringent national and international standards.
From 2015, everything was totally clear from us. The past was very clear, and we found that it's a very great opportunity in order to present the system. And officially, by the year 2017, we started launching a very, very fast, reliable platform that was working based on the chemiluminescence, and that platform was totally automatic. I mean, the majority of the process that you could see in the laboratories that has been done by manual back then in 2007, in 2015 was totally automatic. Everything, I mean, from the random access processes, by the assay menu use, by the processing the human bloods and also serums, until getting the results and the other things. And it was very, very attractive for me because it was the first time that an Iranian company could manage to present this platform in a very, very reliable way. And it was, unlike the others, it was not, affected by the sanctions that we had.
This company stands on the cusp of exporting its products and has already begun sending samples to European markets. It is also open to cross-border collaborations, particularly with neighboring regions, as most of these nations share many of the same values and domestic demands.
From the very beginning, Iran has the eye of the exporting of the products. And I can say for sure, in comparison with the other international brands, we have got the advantages of the pricing. And if we keep the quality stable, definitely we will be the winner of the game. Definitely the safest way is not going far away. But we are a little bit aggressive in this case. And we started working with some countries in the Europe. We just sent samples over there in order to be performed, in order to be checked. And we also were participating in medical trade shows in order to show that we are also having the capabilities of doing the production. And we are a brand made in Iran, but we are also proud of being in Iran. We do not want to change something. We do not want to be fake. And we want to say that despite having a lot of troubles of sanctions, we are here, we are still alive, and we want to keep going forward.
At the height of the U.S.-imposed sanctions, Noyan was taking big strides in advancing biotechnology products and other knowledge transfers. This company believes that with diligence and ingenuity, it can create exceptional opportunities despite challenges posed by the sanctions.
I do remember when the first sanctions happened, it was just like a shock to the society because everyone was locked. What to do, how to do, how to deal with these things, how to transfer the money, and so on. But we learned. We learned how to make the processes much more clear, how to find the balance between the supply and production, how to make the quality stable. I can say for sure, nobody can say the society is not affected by the sanctions. But the point is that we learned and we become strong. There's a saying that whatever doesn't kill you makes you strong. And it definitely makes the Iranian society strong, because now, in comparison with, I can say 13 years ago, there are at least 100 times manufacturers in this field, and they're trying to upgrade their quality. I do believe it's a beneficial advantage for the Iranian society. Otherwise, if you see that we are going back to the history on 2007, more than 95% of the consumption in the whole area of the laboratory has been imported from the outside, while now I can say at least 60%, at least 60% has been manufactured, how to say, locally, and in comparison with the manufacturers that are located outside, our quality talks.
When the coronavirus broke out, domestic knowledge-based companies led the battle by expanding their production lines. All medicine used to treat COVID-19 have been manufactured domestically so far. This goes to show how the industry is on top of scientific developments. There are roughly 500 medical equipment manufacturers active in the country that produce tens of thousands of products. Here's more on the market.
Iran has a robust industry for producing medical devices. The private sector has invested millions towards manufacturing in this field. The bulk of machine parts, including software, can be developed and engineered by domestic firms. It might be interesting to know that the domestic medical device market has grown by 9% since last year. This is why the global average growth was about 6%. That's based on the Office of Medical Equipment at the Ministry of Health. Back in 2018, the National Medical Device Directorate estimated Iran's market in this field was worth nearly $3 billion. The exact figure for this year has not been updated, but it's likely to be much higher. According to the directorate, currently 105 Iranian types of medical equipment and products are exported to 55 countries worldwide, in which your diagnostic kits are at the top of the list with around 30% of the export market. Roughly 500,000 types of medical devices and equipment are made across the globe. Iran is able to domestically manufacture 56% of those available in the world. Important items such as vital sign monitors, operating room monitors, and incubators are among medical devices being exported to Asia-Pacific right now.
Medical devices are not the only products keeping the healthcare industry afloat. Pharmaceutical productions also greatly contribute to this sector. And the pharmaceutical industry is pulsing with new medicines each year. Some 3,000 medicines in thousands of variations are currently produced in Iran. There are some 120 pharmaceutical companies nationwide and around 70 units that specialize in producing raw material needed in this sector.
According to officials, pharmaceutical imports have dramatically dropped by 90% over the years. Domestically produced medicine has helped save the country billions. Iran reduced its currency flight from over $4 billion in 2017 to nearly half that number in 2020. That's going off of statistics from the Food and Drug Administration. Figures from the National Pharmaceutical Syndicate show Iran's domestic pharma market was worth $4.5 billion in 2021. 97% of the pharmaceuticals currently consumed in the country are also domestically produced, making the country nearly self-sufficient in this area.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Let's go check it out.
Entertainment and recreation are as old as the human history and have changed according to the technological advances of the day. However, the emergence of digital games have come at the cost of detaching us from our real-time interaction with our fellow humankind and led to a sedentary lifestyle. That's where companies like Karoshan step in to bridge that gap by designing and building motor skills equipment for amusement parks. The fledgling company has brought together top specialized experts in the field of children from around the country to design amusement parks that cover all age groups, with a focus on children between the ages of 4 and 12. The equipment made by Karoshan are produced based on the ergonomic and intellectual needs of each age group, both boosting their physical activity and enhancing their mental skills. The entertainment industry is constantly growing, and the Iranian brand says it needs to keep abreast of the latest trends. To this end, it has under its belt a dedicated R&D team that scouts for any new advancement in the field. There's a famous Iranian saying that goes, "A healthy mind is a result of a healthy body." And Karoshan is trying to materialize the exact same thing. The Iranian brand says at a time when technology is pervading every aspect of our lives, promoting entertainments that enhance our physical activity will build a healthier generation.
We are getting close to the end of our program, but before we go, let's check out some interesting news and trends in this industry and its related trades. If you like trade shows and exhibits, this bit of news is just for you. The capital city of Tehran will be holding a leather exhibition in January dedicated to accessories, shoes, clothing, furniture, and so much more. Nearly 150 companies will be participating in the three-day event. Businesses will be able to showcase their latest products and capabilities in the exhibition. The main purpose is for producers and other industry participants to expand their networks and find new markets. Also, the exhibit is a platform for knowledge transfer as businesses present their latest technical and industrial achievements in this field. Plus, such events offer opportunities for foreign investment, entrepreneurship, and sustainable employment. In Iran, much of the domestically produced leather is used to make shoes, and the industry is booming with massive productions. Presently, Iran can produce around 450 million pairs of shoes annually. That's according to the Iranian Association of Shoe Manufacturers. The sector is now setting a goal to increase yearly productions to 1 billion pairs of shoes in the next few years. The association estimates this would rake in around $6 billion in export revenues. Tehran plans to increase its shoe exports to neighboring regions as well as landlocked Central Asian countries. Market analysts attribute the growth in the domestic shoe industry to ban on shoe imports, which was implemented in 2018. They also argue that the fluctuation in the dollar exchange rate prompted more Iranians to turn to reasonably affordable domestically produced shoes. And with that, we wrap up our program for today. Thanks for tuning in, stay safe, and I will see you next time.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
شیخ کاظم علی.
اعوذ بالله من الشیطان اللین الرجیم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم و بهی نستعین و صل الله علی سیدنا محمد و اهل بیته الطیبین الطاهرین. اللهم صل علی محمد و آل محمد و عجل فرجهم. I welcome you all to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program For Humanity, and you're talking about Hollywood conditioning of the subconscious mind and the extermination of human rights. I'm sure you all must have heard of Sigmund Freud. So far, what we have discussed is that how they condition the subconscious mind of human beings, and this enables them to control the choices, the free will of the human beings, which means that they are trampling the human rights of human beings on the grounds that the freedom to choose, the freedom for choice is being taken away from them. We discussed the Ivan Pavlov experiment earlier. Today we are going to talk about Sigmund Freud and his nephew Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays was Sigmund Freud's nephew, and he was inclined towards psychological studies. He spent some time with his uncle Sigmund Freud and learned some of the essentials of human behavior. And then he used these psychological discussions and psychological learnings in areas where these are really dangerous for human beings. Like I mentioned earlier, the human rights, when they were created, when they were used and they were brought to the light, they were used for the benefits of human beings. And later on, people politicized it. Later on, the governments used it for sanctions and implementing economic pressure on people. Similarly, these psychological learnings were used for controlling human beings. They were now being brought into politics and economics so that these can be used for the political benefit of the government, and these can be used for the economic benefits of the organizations. So let me narrate this experiment that Edward Bernays conducted in America in 1940s. During the 1940s, the American cigarette industry was facing a downfall. They said, we're making more cigarettes because of the industrial revolution. Our production is really high, but our sales are really low. Why? Because 50% of the population does not use cigarette, which means only men smoke and women do not smoke. So they hired Edward Bernays, a psychologist, and told him that what is it that we can do to increase our sales? Now, this is where I want you to understand that how these people use these psychological learnings to influence our choices and take away that human right that we talk about, that we are free to choose. One of our fundamental human rights is free to choose, right? So how are they influencing our choices? And not just influencing, literally telling us what to do. And this is where you will understand that how the psychologists come into picture and influence us. So Edward Bernays was given the task of increasing the sales of cigarettes. So Edward Bernays said, okay, you know what, give me a couple of, he reached out to rich, young, beautiful women, and he said, I need five young, rich, beautiful women. During their Independence Day parade, he brought in these good-looking women to this parade where all the youth, all the men are gathered, and all the women are gathered to watch the parade. These women get off the car and they take out cigarettes and they start smoking cigarettes in front of the gathering of hundreds and thousands of people. And tomorrow in the newspaper, it is printed as women smoking, tortures of freedom. women smoking torches of freedom. And then this has gone out to explain that those who smoke are the ones who truly feel the freedom. They are the ones who are the carriers of the torches of freedom. And suddenly all the women in America felt the sense that, oh, if I want to show that I'm free, then I need to start smoking. If I want to show that I'm not oppressed, if I want to show that I'm not cornered in the house, I'm not a slave in the house, I need to smoke. And suddenly, within 3 months, the sales of cigarettes went up.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
So here's the point that I want to emphasize upon, that how the Western world, on one hand, talks about human rights, and on the other hand, influences us, condition us to do and behave in the way they want, right? So this is where the right to choose gets trampled, right? This is similar to what they do for the children's right. When you look at the children's cartoon system, when you look at the animations that they have in place, you will realize that they don't even care for children. They do all that for money. They do it for power. They do it for position. And that is what is important for them. Just like Fir'aun, who used to say, "Ana Rabbukumul A'la," these are the guys who are using all the technology to monitor and watch children and watch their habits and design advertisements. Let me give you an example of one of the advertisements for ice creams and Skittles. When they wanted to design some advertisement for ice creams and Skittles, they brought in little children who were about 1.5 years, 2 years old. They got them to sit in front of TV and they played different types of advertisements for ice creams and Skittles. And then they placed extremely high-tech cameras around these children to monitor these children, that the number of times they blink during the advertisement. So if an advertisement is 1.5 minutes long, how many times does the child blink during the advertisement? Not just that, but they focus their cameras on the pupils of the children to see that how do the pupils of the children dilate? How much do they dilate? How much are they focused on the advertisement? If they notice that the children blinked more often during the advertisement, they said these advertisements are useless, throw them away, let's design and come up with more advertisements. If they saw that the pupils dilated more, they knew that the children are stuck to the TV, attached to the TV, focused on it, and therefore these are good advertisements. And these advertisements were selected, and these are the ones that are presented on the TV. That's why we see that when our children are sitting in front of the TV and they're looking at it, they are so stuck to the TV that even when you call them, they don't listen to us. Inshallah, we will continue this in our next episode. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ahli baytihi tayyibin at-tahirin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, you were there when the Prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair. Engraved in his heart were the words of his Lord. To all of mankind, this was his call. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. O people, praise only Allah, glorify Allah. Of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah.
is no God but Allah. Muhammad is his messenger.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.